All right, let's jump right in. Today we're going deep on a fascinating Illinois law case, one that really makes you think about the power of words.
Oh yeah, this one's a doozy. It really gets at the heart of a question a lot of us have probably wondered about at some point.
Can words alone ever be so powerful, so damaging, that they justify violence?
Exactly. We're talking about the People v. Chevalier case, which actually involves two separate cases that were consolidated and heard all the way up at the Illinois Supreme Court.
And these cases are about?
Two husbands, Chevalier and Flores. They both killed their wives after some really intense arguments about infidelity.
I see. So a classic crime of passion scenario.
Well, that's what the husbands argued. They claimed that their wives' confessions of adultery, like the actual words themselves, triggered such extreme heat of passion that they lost control and acted without thinking.
So essentially, they're claiming temporary insanity. Like the words were so powerful, they weren't in their right minds.
Pretty much. They were trying to get their charges reduced from murder to manslaughter, arguing that the provocation was so severe it negated their intent to kill.
And did the court buy it?
Nope, not at all. The Illinois Supreme Court upheld the murder convictions in both cases, sending a very clear message.
Which is?
That in Illinois, words alone, no matter how hurtful or inflammatory, are not enough to meet the legal standard for what's called serious provocation.
So it's not a my words made me do it kind of defense.
Not in Illinois, no. The court really doubled down on that point, too. They actually overruled some of their own previous decisions that had hinted that verbal admissions of adultery could, in some cases, be enough to mitigate a murder charge.
Wow, that's a pretty big deal. It sounds like the court was trying to draw a very clear line in the sand.
Yeah.
But why do you think they went to such lengths? What was the reasoning behind this strict interpretation?
Well, you have to remember the context. The court is responsible for establishing clear, objective standards that can be applied consistently in all cases. They can't let every perceived wrong, every hurtful statement, become a potential justification for taking a life.
That makes sense. It's like if every time someone got really angry or upset, they could claim heat of passion, the legal system would be in total chaos.
Precisely. And remember, juries are made up of everyday people with all their own individual experiences and biases. The court needs to provide them with a clear framework for making these tough decisions.
So the court was basically trying to prevent the heat of passion defense from becoming a get-out-of-jail-free card for anyone who could spin a good story about being emotionally provoked.
Right. They were trying to establish a consistent and predictable application of the law.
But what exactly does serious provocation mean in the eyes of Illinois law? Like, what kind of actions would meet that standard?
Well, it's all about objective actions, not subjective feelings. Think physical assault, catching someone in the act of adultery, illegal arrest, things like that. Situations where there's an immediate threat of danger or harm.
Got it. So just hearing about infidelity, even if it's a devastating revelation, isn't enough under Illinois law. You'd have to actually witness it happening or be physically attacked or something like that.
That's the key takeaway from this case. The court was making a distinction between words and actions. Words alone, no matter how hurtful, don't justify taking a life.
Wow. This is really fascinating stuff, but also a bit unsettling to think about. I mean, we all know how powerful words can be. They can certainly wound and inflict emotional pain. But the law is drawing a line saying those wounds, however deep, don't justify a violent response.
It's a tough line to draw, for sure, and definitely raises some interesting questions about the limits of the law and the complexities of human emotion. But that's a conversation for another time. You know, it's interesting because this whole idea of provocation and like where the law draws the line isn't just something Illinois is dealing with.
Oh, really? So other states have different approaches?
Yeah, for sure. Some states have adopted a different standard altogether.
What, like instead of heat of passion?
Exactly. It's called extreme emotional disturbance.
Extreme emotional disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that sounds way more intense than heat of passion.
Yeah, it kind of is. It takes into account a much wider range of factors.
Like what kind of factors? What makes it so different from heat of passion?
Think of it this way. Heat of passion is like a sudden burst of anger, right? It's reactive. Something happens and boom, you just lose it.
Like a sudden explosion. Got it.
But extreme emotional disturbance is more like a slow burn. It acknowledges that sometimes a person's actions are the result of a whole bunch of things, you know?
Like a pressure cooker.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It could be built up stress trauma, a history of abuse, even mental health issues. It recognizes that people can snap under the weight of all that.
So it's not just about a single triggering event like in the Chevalier case.
Right. It's about understanding the context of a person's life and their emotional state leading up to the crime.
It seems like that'd be so hard to define, though.
Right.
Right? Like, how do you measure extreme emotional disturbance in a court of law?
Yeah, it's definitely not easy. It often involves digging into the defendant's past, looking for evidence of things like psychological trauma or mental illness.
And I'm guessing expert witnesses like psychologists and psychiatrists would play a big role in these
Oh,
cases.
absolutely. They'd be crucial in helping the jury understand the complex interplay of emotions and behaviors that can lead to violence.
So it's like trying to piece together a psychological puzzle, showing that the defendant's actions while criminals weren't totally out of the blue, given their unique circumstances.
You got it. It's about trying to see the world through the defendant's eyes and understanding what might have driven them to that point.
I can see how this approach might be more nuanced and maybe even more compassionate. But it also seems like it could be easily abused.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's one of the big criticisms of this standard.
Like, does it make it too easy for people to get away with murder? Does it weaken the deterrent effect of the law?
Those are definitely valid concerns. But the people who support this approach argue that it's not about excusing violence at all.
What do they say it's about then?
They say it's about ensuring that the punishment fits the crime and the individual's culpability. Someone who commits a crime in a state of extreme emotional disturbance might be less morally blameworthy than someone who plans a murder in cold blood, you know?
I guess that makes sense. It's like saying not all murders are created equal and the law should reflect that.
Right. It's about recognizing that human behavior is complex and that sometimes people make terrible choices under extreme duress.
This whole conversation is making me think about something else you mentioned earlier. Hearsay evidence. Didn't that play a role in one of these cases?
You're right, the Flores case. There were some questions about whether certain testimony regarding threats Flores had allegedly made against his wife should have been allowed.
Yeah, hearsay evidence. That's like secondhand information, right? Isn't that usually inadmissible in court?
Most of the time, yeah. It's considered unreliable because you're relying on someone else's account of what was said.
And there's always the chance that they misunderstood things or got the story wrong, right?
Exactly. Or even intentionally lied. And since the person who made the original statement isn't there to testify under oath, there's no way to cross-examine them and test their credibility.
So how did hearsay evidence even come up in the Flores case? Was there an exception to the rule?
There are some exceptions, yeah. And while the court's opinion doesn't specifically say which one applied here, it probably falls under the statement against interest rule.
Okay, remind me what that is.
Basically, it allows hearsay statements that would have incriminated the person who made them. The idea is that people wouldn't usually say things that could get them in trouble unless those things were actually true.
So even though the court said there might have been some issues with allowing this hearsay evidence, they didn't think it ultimately affected the outcome of the case.
Right. They called it harmless error, meaning it wouldn't have changed the verdict even if it had been excluded.
Seems like a lot of these legal concepts are kind of murky, aren't they? Like they're not always as black and white as we might think.
That's a good point. And this case is a perfect example of that. It's like the court was trying to find a balance between acknowledging the complexities of human emotion and upholding clear legal standards.
And it seems like they ultimately leaned more towards clarity and consistency, even if it meant potentially oversimplifying the emotional aspects of the case.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment, but it also makes you wonder, right? Like, how do these age-old legal concepts keep up with the times?
Especially in a world where technology is changing the way we communicate and interact at such a rapid pace.
Exactly. I mean, think about it. Could a barrage of hateful tweets or online harassment ever be considered serious provocation in a court of law?
Whoa, that's a scary thought. It's like the courtroom is colliding with the wild west of the internet.
It's something courts are actually grappling with right now. The line between the virtual world and the real world is getting blurrier every day, and the law is struggling to keep up.
It's definitely something to think about. And it makes this whole conversation about the power of words and the limits of provocation even more relevant and urgent.
Yeah, it really does make you think about how the legal system is going to adapt to this increasingly digital world. I mean, where do we draw the line between words and actions when those lines are becoming so blurred?
It's a really good question. And it brings us back to that other standard we were talking about earlier, the whole extreme emotional disturbance thing.
Right. That seemed like a much more nuanced approach than heat of passion. But it also seemed a lot harder to define and prove in court.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely more complex. But I think it gets at something really important that we've been talking about. How do we balance the messiness of human emotions with the need for clear legal boundaries? Okay, break that down for me. How does extreme emotional disturbance address that balance?
Well, like we said before, heat of passion is very reactive, right? It requires that specific triggering event, something that happens right then and there. But extreme emotional disturbance recognizes that sometimes a person's actions are the result of a much longer, more complicated emotional journey.
Like a buildup of stress, trauma, all those things we were talking about.
Exactly. It acknowledges that people don't always act rationally and that sometimes those actions are influenced by factors that are beyond their control.
But wouldn't this approach make it incredibly difficult to determine guilt or innocence? How can you possibly measure something like extreme emotional disturbance objectively?
It's a challenge, no doubt. And that's why expert testimony is so crucial in these cases. You need psychologists, psychiatrists, people who can really delve into the defendant's psychological history and help the jury understand what might have been going on in their mind at the time of the crime.
So it's not just about what happened in the moments leading up to the crime, but also about the broader context of their life experiences, their mental state, their history of trauma or abuse, all of that.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that people don't exist in a vacuum. Their actions are shaped by their past, their relationships, their struggles.
It's a very different way of thinking about criminal responsibility, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's almost like saying, okay, you did this terrible thing, but let's try to understand why.
In a way, yeah. It's about empathy, yes, but also about justice. It's about making sure that the punishment fits not just the crime, but also the individual's level of culpability.
It all raises some really tough questions, though. Like, does this approach make it too easy for people to get away with murder? Does it weaken the deterrent effect of the law?
Those are legitimate concerns, for sure. And it's a debate that's been going on for a long time. But the people who support this approach argue that it's not about excusing violence. It's about recognizing the degrees of responsibility.
They're saying that not all murders are created equal, and the law should reflect those nuances.
Right. It's about moving away from a one-size-fits-all approach to criminal justice and towards a system that acknowledges the complexity of human behavior.
This has been a really thought-provoking deep dive. We've covered so much ground. From the specifics of the Chevalier case to these broader questions about the nature of provocation, the evolution of legal standards, and the challenges of applying age-old legal principles to a world that's changing faster than ever.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack. But it really gets at the heart of what makes law so fascinating. You know, it's constantly evolving, grappling with new challenges, trying to find that balance between justice and mercy, predictability and adaptability.
For all our listeners out there, especially those of you who are just starting out in your legal careers, the People v. Chevalier case is definitely one to remember.
It's a great example of how the law is trying to navigate these really complex issues around human emotion and criminal responsibility, and it raises some really profound questions about how the law will need to adapt as our world becomes increasingly digital.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, here's something to think about. In a world where words can spread like wildfire online, where a single tweet can have real-world consequences, how do we define the limits of provocation? And how do we make sure that the law keeps pace with these changes while still upholding the principles of justice and fairness?
It's something we all need to be thinking about, both as legal professionals and as citizens. The conversation is far from over.